It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 12th, 2022. My first guest is Matt Stoller, the research director at the American Economic Liberties Project. The organization is nonprofit and nonpartisan, and it's a part of a growing cross-ideological movement to combat monopolistic corporations and the systems that entrench their power. But what does that mean, and how does their work relate to the bicycle business? Because in fact it does, in a way that I think may both interest and infuriate you. Matt will be with me in a moment. In the second half of the show, I'm offering up an encore presentation of another iconic frame builder, one who influenced our custom bicycle world for years and years. And since it was his birthday this past week, I thought I'd bring him back. Tom Kellogg is no longer building frames, but his contributions to the artisan bicycle world were and continue to be immense. Happy birthday to him, and you can hear our conversation in the second half of the show. Over the past few decades, the bike industry has become more and more consolidated. Where we used to see robust competition and innovation from the likes of Suntour and Stronglite, to name just a couple, we now see just Shimano and SRAM and a little bit of Campagnolo running their distant seconds and thirds, with a smattering of companies treading water in the bottom of the barrel. Where we saw independent bicycle shops literally on every corner in America, we now see Trek and specialized company stores as the two behemoths buy up smaller independent shops with the intention to either take them over or shut them down. The bicycle industry isn't, of course, the only place this is or has been happening. Consolidation and vertical integration has been going on in pharmacies, groceries, and with Amazon in the mix, just about every other industry on the planet. The antitrust laws and regulations that have been on the books for decades have been loosened, ignored, or conveniently disregarded, with little political will to strengthen or enforce them. So this begs a big question for me, although there is probably more than one. Is this a good thing? Is it possible that the pendulum is beginning to swing in the other direction, and is there political will to help it along? Matt Stoller is the research director at the American Economic Liberties Project, and his article titled "The Bicycle Thieves" appeared in his newsletter Big on Substack. In it, Matt calls out those who are trying to build a world without independent bicycle shops. So you know I had to contact him for a conversation. Hi, Matt. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Where are you?
I am in Washington, D.C.
We are on the same time zone. That is nice. Yes. So you published a piece on January 21st that caught my eye, illustrating a lot of issues that are going on in the bike business, some that we've been talking about for a long time and some that are relatively new. And you made some good points. I want to know about you and your background and how you became interested in monopolies and antitrust.
Yeah. So I don't know that much about bikes, bicycling. But I'm a market power person, right? So, which is to say, I write about monopolies and the legal structures that underpin them. And I got my start, I'm not a lawyer, but I got my start as a policy advisor in Congress during the financial crisis. I'd say got my start in this sort of area and got interested in the consolidation of economic power and the reason and the legal underpinnings. And then over the last, I'd say 10 years or so, I studied more and more specific markets and different types of antitrust law and regulatory policy. And now I write a newsletter called Big, which is on Substack, where I'll just write about different things that I'm finding, often sort of political choices that policymakers and enforcers are making or specific markets. And in the, you know, in this case, I, some friends of mine told me about the local roll-ups of some bicycle shops, folks, you know, and I've known that there were problems in the bicycle market for a while, but then they basically helped me understand how the bicycle industry works. And I thought it was a good case study in monopolization.
Understanding how the bicycle industry works is, I mean, if somebody really does understand it, I would really like to know that after 46 years in the industry. I still am not sure how it works all the time. But what is going on right now is interesting. And it's kind of scary for the independent bicycle dealer, who is the sort of the underpinning of the bicycle industry. I mean, independent bike shops are where most people can remember from little kids going to get a bike, you know, getting it fixed, having a tire, flat tire, and they are being squeezed out. So I'm wondering how and what is, you use a term, monopoly of power. What does that mean? And then let's talk about how that might relate to the bike business.
Yeah, so monopolization is when a firm or a set of firms imposes unified control over a branch of trade or commerce. That's all it is. It's just unified control. And you can also have it split into a few firms that are in a very consolidated industry. That's, the term for that is oligopoly. And they're pretty similar to monopoly, although there's a little bit more flexibility. The economists look at, I'm not an economist, but they look at monopolies and they see what they do in terms of price effects. So prices go down, quality changes and whatnot. But there are broader political impacts, like the fact that you have one or two bosses of an industry and they set the terms by which everyone buys and sells and organizes quality standards, terms of service. And, you know, the industry is not just the consumers, it's also the independent dealers, it's the manufacturers, the workers. And so if you have a small group of people that are controlling that industry, that's a lot of political power over that industry, not over politics per se, but over the politics of that industry. And so in a sense, it's like having a monopoly is like having a mini autocracy, but over a market. Since we've changed, you know, just the context here, since we've changed antitrust law in the early 80s to make, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, to make consolidation much easier, you've seen the rise of these like kind of mini autocracies in every market in the country. Often it's a global trend too. So over the last 25 years or 20 years, 75% of industries have become more consolidated. So you see it in big markets. I think there's a bunch of high profile antitrust suits against firms like Google and Facebook. But so it's search and social networking, but also airlines and cable and like the big markets are very consolidated, but also the smaller markets and through things like mail sorting software. I just learned of one that I'm researching, but like fake eyelashes, apparently there's monopolization going on there. I don't know for sure, but like what I'm looking into, cheerleading. And then of course, you know, bicycles, you want to call that a big industry, a small industry, obviously it's an important industry because it's a form of travel and, you know, lots of hobbyists and stuff and exercise. There's really a duopoly, I think, that controls the market. But the industry is kind of becoming vertically integrated, sort of the way that what you saw Hollywood has now become a set of dominant streaming firms. And that's kind of what's happening to the bicycle industry. And it's through the purchase of these of the independent bike shop, as you kind of noted. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And I'm sure you know a lot more about it.
I'm not sure that I know a lot more about it, but I certainly am watching it happen. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Matt Soler. He is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. He writes a blog, I guess you'd call it a blog, on Substack called Big. That says it all right there. You mentioned in your article about Specialized and about Trek, and they're going out and they're buying these little chains. So somebody might own two stores, three stores. You know, we've always had this problem with Trek coming in and dictating who can be a dealer. You know, so you sign your dealer agreement and then they say they're going to give you protected territory and that doesn't happen. And so there are a lot of kind of underhanded things going on in the bicycle business. But I'm beginning to see these big guys as doing a lot more than that. And so What is the downside of forcing these shops to sell, number one? And you think that they're not being forced, but you know, you get an offer that you just think you'll never get because as a little retailer, your store was never worth that much. And you probably can't say no to these guys. What are the downsides of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that if you don't accept it, then they can make it harder and harder to get equipment, right? I mean, if you want to sell bikes in the pandemic and there's a bike shortage or there's a shortage of certain components, guess who's going to get those components first? Like, it's not going to be you. It's going to be the big stores, or it's going to be the specialized, you know, stores that are owned by one of the big bike brands. So you're at a competitive disadvantage. And then someone comes to you and gives you an offer for your store. And then there's a kind of or else type of you know, it's an offer you can't refuse. And this is not just, this is a common thing that's happening across the economy. So it happens, for example, independent pharmacies. CVS does this, where they have control over an upstream part of the industry, which is basically like a certain form of pharmaceutical pricing. And so they control the part of the revenue stream that goes to their competitors. And then they'll go to their competitor and say, hey, your revenue, we're going to cut your revenue. Oh, but by the way, here's an offer because we want to purchase your business. And I know times have been tough because your revenue keeps going down. And it's like, they are the ones that cut the revenue. And so I think you see this. And so a lot of independent pharmacies are selling out to CVS, who will often shut down the pharmacy, right? Because they're really just trying to eliminate competition. But you see this kind of across the board in other industries. And I think with the bicycle industry, I don't exactly know what is going on, like what the market power dynamics are. But I think there's one of two possibilities. So I think when you have like a firm like Specialized or Trek or something like that coming in and buying a store or a set of stores, and then they basically make that store an exclusive to their products. Are they doing it because they want to gain market power to the end user, or are they doing it kind of as a defensive strategy against the producers of components, who are SRAM and Shimano, right? So maybe there's a defensive arrangement where SRAM and Shimano are squeezing everybody in the industry, and so the big bike producers who are getting squeezed are saying, well, we'll acquire guaranteed market share, and then we can use our bargaining power to push back on those guys who are dominant. It's hard to tell, but either way, like what is happening is you're seeing a consolidation and a vertical integration of the industry. That's what it's called.
What do you think the long-term effect of this kind of economic behavior is?
Well, it just makes it a brittle industry, and it makes it much harder for anyone to enter. Ultimately, you'll probably have fewer bike stores. And I know there's been some new brands that have come into the market in the last 10 years. Like one of my friends is like, oh, there's all these cool American brands that have come in. And they're not able to, you know, they wouldn't be able to enter the market, right? I mean, like if you want to sell in the retail space, you basically used to be able to sell to lots of independent stores, and you go to a grocery store or a Five and Dime or whatever, and you'd say, hey, would you see if my product sells? And whatever it was, you could put your product there, Juicy Fruit, you know, new type of gum, whatever. And if it sold, then they would buy more. And then you go to other stores. And that's how we had this like really vibrant retail sector that introduced new products on a regular basis and had pretty good pricing. And then when we stopped enforcing antitrust law in the 1970s and 1980s, then that's when the kind of Walmart effect happened. And you saw the rise of giant firms like Walmart and Target, and then later on Amazon. And these firms, what they didn't compete based on service or selection, they competed based on bargaining power with the supplier. It's not that they were the cheapest because they were the most efficient, although some of them were more efficient than the independents, some of them were not. It's that they had more bargaining power over the supplier. They could get a better wholesale price or than their smaller competitors. And that practice of price, what's called price discrimination, used to be illegal. So it used to be illegal to say to the little guy, I'm going to give you a worse price or worse, you know, supply contracts than to the bigger guy. And then when they stopped enforcing that, you saw the explosion of these chain stores. And the consequence of it is that it is just much harder to introduce new products into the retail space these days, because if you do, you know that someone in Bentonville, or there are a room full of lawyers in Bentonville or in Seattle who are just thinking about how to take your margin. And so, you know, from a period, you had more people like on third-party sellers on Amazon introducing new products, but people have become wise to the fact that there's not really a profitable way to do that. Like, you know, someone's going to do a knockoff, or Amazon will, since they have surveillance over your business, will just copycat it. If you try to go through like a Walmart, if you don't have like really strong brand, like a really strong brand, then they'll copycat it, or they'll just bargain you down so you don't have any ability to make money. And the net effect of that is that stuff in aggregate is getting more expensive, worse quality, and there's not innovation, or there's a much less innovation across the consumer space than we are used to seeing. And I think that's what you'll see and you've probably already seen some of it in the bicycle world as it consolidates.
Yeah, you know, paint all the bikes black and you won't know whose it is. They all have the same component. They all are carbon fiber. They're all, you know, using whatever wheels.
And I think the other thing that's sort of interesting is the powertrains and the attempt to the electronic, just for the electronic, yeah, shifting. Which, you know, I don't know if that, again, I'm not like a big biker, but apparently, you know, when I look at the bike reviews, everyone's like, electronic shifting is amazing. You have to do it. And the thing that I think is interesting about that is it introduces whole new levels of control, because it's software and there are, you know, they're not doing it yet, but Shimano and SRAM can impose prohibitions on who gets to repair it. So this is an issue, like for your iPhone, like if you try to get it repaired at an unauthorized dealer or do it yourself, like Apple prohibits that. They won't sell the tools or the software. And they just started loosening that a little bit. But you see this like John Deere tractors, like even military equipment, there are restrictions on the ability to repair. And so that's one of the things that you could increasingly see. I mean, I imagine that might even be happening now, but especially as things turn electronic and digital, there are all sorts of new ways for dominant firms to enforce rights on property that you thought you owned, but in fact, they control.
Well, it is interesting that they are no longer supporting and or producing a lot of mechanical drivetrains. And it's something that is very frustrating to custom builders, especially. So small custom builders, that's what my husband does. He custom builds bikes, you know, are sort of forced into things like disc brakes and through axles and electronic shifting, whether he wants to do them or not, and whether he believes in them or not. So it sort of is taking the creativity out of, you know, the artisan part of the business, which really is a lot of where new ideas came from, was the artisan, you know, and now it's coming from some lab in Japan.
Well, I mean, or it's not coming from anywhere.
Or it's,
I mean,
not, right.
That I think is like it, whether it comes from a lab in Japan or an artisan is not, I mean, there's a sort of something more romantic about it coming from a tinkerer. But the problem today is, and this is true in a lot of industries, is you don't actually have to innovate. Now, I'm told that Shimano and SRAM are innovative and they are producing better stuff all the time. So I'm not, I mean, and I think people seem to like them. But do you really want to risk having them be the only innovators in the industry?
You don't have a lot of choice.
Well, right. And if you stop producing, you know, the kind of, I guess we'll call it analog or mechanical parts, then it makes it, it makes the personal computer industry in the 80s and 90s, where you could, there are lots of different parts that there were competitive markets and lots of different. And basically the only parts where there wasn't competition was the microprocessor and the operating system. So Intel and Microsoft, but the rest of the industry was this open system with lots of innovation and competition. And now, but you like compare that to like phones, smartphones today, where you basically have two smartphones, you have Apple and you have the Android systems, and you know, they're great, you know, they're great phones, but like you get a choice of one of those two. And there isn't really any outside of what you know, Tim Cook or Sundar Pichai decide to innovate on. And that is I think that's an open question about whether we want to live in a society where these things that are important to us, the choices about what they are, what they can do, who can manipulate them or tinker with them, are done by a small.
I'm going to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Matt Stoller. He is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project, and his blog is on Substack called Big. The last thing I want to talk about is what you think it's going to take to actually start making a change in this. What are some of the remedies you would put in place or would hope to see maybe legislatively put in place that will turn business into a healthier, more robust way of being?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the answer is antitrust suits, right? So antitrust is the body of law that is meant to deal with what's called monopolization or restraints of trade. And so these can be things like contracting provisions that say, you know, exclusive deals, like you can only buy from Shimano or you can only sell to so-and-so. Things like these buying up of these bike shops, which is what's called vertical integration. And that you could say that's illegal under the Clayton Act, which is an anti-merger statute. There are a whole bunch of rebating practices that are kind of predatory, where the more you buy from one entity, the better price you get. Right. And so then if you start to buy from someone else, then you will get less of a rebate. And it's a kind of an exclusive dealing type of arrangement. You could say that that's a restraint of trade under the law. And then this is a, you know, antitrust law is sort of weird. So you could have government enforcers bring these cases. That would be on a federal level, the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. You could have state attorneys general do it. You could also have, there are also private rights of action. So individuals could bring these kinds of cases, but they're very expensive to bring. And the law has been substantially weakened and warped. So, you know, there are some possible changes at a state level, and there are possible changes that are happening at a federal level. But for right now, I think the kind of core of it is to surface more information about how these firms act. And I think that one of the things that I found, you know, that was interesting about how the bicycle industry works is there's a lot of non-disclosure agreements in the contracting arrangements. And I think, like, if you could have congressional investigation or state legislative investigations, basically just to say, what do these contracts look at? What are they hiding? And if you showed, here's what the contracts say, maybe you can, like, if the contracts are showing anti-competitive behavior, then it will make it much easier to bring these kinds of suits. And that, I think, you could change the market, pretty quickly. If you were to say you can't have exclusive deals, you can't do these predatory rebates, you can't buy up these independent bike stores, you can't allocate bicycle or component supply based on the amount of market power that one customer has versus another. That's a law called the Robinson-Patman Act, which the FTC hasn't enforced for 30 or 40 years, but is still on the books.
And that becomes the question. So is there any will to do this? I agree that all these things would be helpful. All these things might put retail or business or industry back on a track that makes sense to me. But nobody seems to have the will to do that. You know, everybody calls Facebook up to Congress and they walk away.
So let me give you some optimism. Okay.
Oh, good.
So, yeah. All right. So, and then it's kind of like a stupid version of optimism, but it's what I got. All right. So, so Facebook, right. You've heard of this stupid thing called the metaverse.
Yeah.
It's not really a thing, right? It's just virtual reality.
Right.
Anyway, so Mark Zuckerberg is dedicating $10 billion a year to making virtual reality better. And is kind of dumb. And I think, like, he's a really boring person and I'm not, you know, excited about it, but he is doing that. And it's kind of cool that there's $10 billion that's going to creating a better product, some real research versus buying back stock or, you know, buying other companies or whatever. And meanwhile, like, he can't really buy competitors. And he couldn't start his own currency, which he wanted to. So instead he actually has to invest in research and development. Now, why would he have to do that? And the answer is antitrust scrutiny, right? So he knows that if he tries to buy a big company like Roblox or something like that, then the government will put that under a lot of scrutiny and may not let him do it. And so he's trying to go and actually, you know, trying to invent something new, which, you know, he hasn't done since the original Facebook product. And so that's like, that's actually a really, that's a pretty dramatic success story, even though it doesn't look like success because, you know, he's still worth a lot of money and it's still very annoying and difficult. Like that is actually a significant policy success. Meanwhile, there are cases that are going, so it's not like this is the end of the road, but we've actually succeeded in that area. And so the reason that we've done that is because I'm part of a political movement, it's called the anti-monopoly movement, sometimes called the new Brandeis movement after Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. And we've made the argument for about 5 to 10 years that we really need to look at market power in a different way. That we, you know, the traditional way of thinking about antitrust since the 1970s and 80s was to say, well, is this practice of a merger or vertical restraint or contracting exclusive dealing, whatever it is this promoting efficiency? And that's the way that the antitrust establishment looked at the world. And so they would look at, you know, Trek buying stores and they would say, oh, Trek says they can sell more bicycles more efficiently. And so it's efficient and good. And we believe that that's not a good way to understand the point of the law. The point of the law is exactly what it says, which is monopolization and restraints of trade are illegal. Not we need to look at whether markets are efficient, but you are not allowed to monopolize. You are not allowed to restrain trade. You're not allowed to engage in price discrimination. You are not allowed to buy firms where the point is to substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly. Like the statutes are very clear. And we believe that they are based on a set of small R Republican values. And we think that they should be enforced as they're written. And that's the kind of the rule of law. That's the rule of law sort of school of thinking. And we've made a lot of progress in that. And the big tech antitrust suits are a result of that. But there's also new leadership at the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice. And these are people who, you know, Jonathan Cantor at DOJ and Lena Khan at the FTC, who are very aggressive about market power questions. But the challenge that they have is literally every part of the economy is consolidated. And so how do you, as a relatively small agency, where do you start, right? And they're doing stuff on big tech. They're doing things on, you know, pharmaceuticals and semiconductors, things like that. Part of what their prioritization, I'm guessing, is going to be oriented around is who is organized and wants something, right? And so the bicycling community is an affinity group. People are very excited about bikes. And if they got together and said, you know, we are really scared about what is happening, and here is a bunch of evidence about what is happening in our industry, we would like you to do something. We would like you to investigate. We would like you to, you know, ask some questions. We want you to bring a suit or whatever it is. If a community, an organized community, were to go to these federal enforcers or even state attorneys general, like that would have a big impact. So as an example, later this month, the FTC holds open hearings every month, where anyone can go and just on Zoom, anyone can just sign up and you get a minute or 2 minutes to just talk about whatever it is that you want. And so you could just go to that and be like, I'm worried about roll-ups in the bicycle industry. And here's what I saw happen. And I would like you to look into this. And you will have 4 Federal Trade Commissioners sitting there on Zoom listening to you. And if 5 people from the bicycling community say, I would like you to look into this, I can't get these parts anymore, I can't buy this kind of bike or whatever it is, they'll hear it. And, you know, that is meaningful. So it's kind of about the more organized the community, you know, the squeaky wheel. There we go.
Yeah, right? That's a good one. Squeaky wheel gets grease.
Yeah, just the squeaky wheel. And it's like, I think people feel so disempowered.
Yeah.
They also don't know that there are these levers that people can use, and they don't have any faith that enforcers or government policymakers will do anything about it for good reason. I mean, things haven't actually been going well in politics. I don't know if you've noticed, but you know, it's things are changing very quickly in my part of the world, which is the market, you know, monopolization part of the world, on a bipartisan basis. I think the Republicans, I'm a Democrat, but the Republicans are coming around on a lot of monopolization questions too, for different reasons. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here. It's just kind of a question of like, are people gonna in the bike industry gonna say, hey, we have an issue here, we'd like you to look into it, and start to bother their public officials about it?
Well, that's a really, really good question. And we'll end with that pretty much. There are a couple of lobbying organizations, League of American Bicyclists and People for Bikes. Now, People for Bikes is backed by Trek.
Right.
Yeah, that is who subsidizes them. But the League of American Bicyclists is everyday people, and they are in Washington as a lobby. And, once a year they go up and knock on doors. But I'm gonna get this stuff from you as to this thing that happens, that we could actually get on Zoom. I could come up with a dozen people who would give their minute of, hey, what's going on here in the bike business? Take a look. I think that's awesome.
I'd totally love to help you. I mean, we've worked with like small grocers who are upset because, you know, Walmart and Amazon are getting.
Sure.
Then they went and lobbied the FTC and said, we'd like you to do an investigation. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. And now they asked for detailed information from a bunch of big firms. And it's called the Federal Trade Commission 6B study on price discrimination. And, you know, it's hard. I'm not going to like, these guys are dealing with every part of the economy, but.
Sure.
But, you know, they if they hear, oh, there's a thing about bicyclists and bikes, it will matter, because also everyone in the agencies are going to be paying attention to what people say as well. So it's just kind of like, use it. It's your gut, right? Demand stuff.
Well, you have a couple of entries into that. You have recreation, transportation, competition. You have a lot of places where the bicycle fits in. And with e-bikes right now, there's a lot of things going on. But the whole thing about what Trek and Specialized are doing, which is what you brought up in your original article, Bicycle Thieves, which I just thought was awesome. It was a great title. Makes so much sense.
The titles are so hard. And I thought
they are hard.
Yeah.
They are hard.
I'm not that good at them. So
caught
I was
my
like,
attention, though. That was a good one. We've been speaking with Matt Stoller. He is the director of research for the American Economic Liberties Project. And we will put up on the blog this week how you can actually get your voices heard, both on the industry side, but there's also the consumer side, because all of us are affected, even as consumers. When you try to go to a bike shop and you can't buy tires and tubes, which is what happened in the pandemic.
Right. Also, it's just like going to a bike store as a kid, it's like, it's such a special experience, and that, you know, you don't want that to go away. Not that it'll totally go away if you have a truck store, but it's like, it's still not going to be as cool.
No, like, it's a completely different experience today than it was certainly when I was a kid. Well, Matt, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it. We will post all this information, and I will keep watching big on Substack.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Later. You have a great day.
You too.
Matt Stoller is the research director at the American Economic Liberties Project. If you are interested in learning more about AELP, you can log on to economicliberties.us. And if you want to follow Matt's work on Substack and subscribe to his newsletter, go to mattstoller.substack.com. Finally, if you are interested in speaking to the powers that be, the next FTC meeting is scheduled for February 17th. A link to that meeting, along with sign-up information to get a spot to speak your piece, is on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, for our February 12th show. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll listen into my 2019 conversation with Tom Kellogg. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Just as he announced his retirement back in spring of 2019, I rang up Tom Kellogg to make sure we had a thorough conversation about his work and his legacy. If you have or had a Merlin titanium bike or one of Tom's Spectrum bikes, you know the kind of craftsman he is. Today, he and his wife are enjoying their retirement, and on the occasion of his birthday this past Thursday, I give you Tom Kellogg. If you own a Merlin or a Spectrum bicycle, you know about the attention to details that a masterful artisan bicycle can have. Over the past three decades, Tom Kellogg's signature on a frame has come to exemplify that kind of mastery. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hello, Tom. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me this week. How are you?
I'm doing really well. Thank you. And you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. I'm actually good. I just hope it warms up soon. It's really cold here in Cleveland. I'm sure it's cold where you are.
It's cold.
So I know it shouldn't have come as a surprise, but it did. March 1st, Bicycling Magazine had an article that says you and Jeff are taking your last orders this year and retiring after your last frame is shipped. I'm not going to ask you the same old questions. I'd like to walk back a little bit and talk about how you first became a frame builder, what you think about the work today. So start by telling us where you grew up. I don't think I knew this.
I was raised just west of Philadelphia in really a very nice area in late high school. And I was at a boarding school. My parents moved from the suburbs into really downtown Philly. And they lived there for many years. So by the time I started getting towards the end of college, and I was up in upstate New York, my parents had been in Philly for a while. And so when I came home, like on vacation and stuff, I'd actually end up in Philly, which I didn't really like, but it was a place to stay. But I grew up just outside Philly.
So where did you go to college? You said upstate. Where?
Right. I went to the University of Rochester. I went there because I got in.
That sounds familiar.
My first choice was in Connecticut, and I was on the wait list there. And honestly, I didn't want to wait. And as it turned out, Rochester was a good choice. I had kind of thought that after high school, I would want to become a science teacher because I had a great science teacher in high school. And I started taking science courses at Rochester, which turned out to be a big mistake. Rochester, at least at the time, was really kind of a pre-med school. So that part of the university was really cutthroat, and it kind of turned me off. But I became very interested in sociology, and ultimately that's what I got my degree in. And I loved it. And as it turned out, sociology was really the best thing I could do, because in my work, I need to be able to read people. I need to be able to talk with them and go through a period of getting to know them. And my training as a sociologist really made that a lot easier. So it turned out well.
You know, life has a way of doing that, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Yeah, it does. So who do you think, besides your science teacher in high school, who obviously was an influence, even if you didn't go into that field, who else do you feel were sort of mentors or people who influenced what became this life's work that you've done?
Okay. You know, I'm thinking about that, and I'll talk about other frame builders and that kind of stuff. But way, way back, it was fifth grade, and you know, I was in middle school, and or actually, that's kind of elementary. And for some reason, in our school, one of the high school math teachers would come down for a week and teach a higher level course to the fifth graders. And I remember this teacher came down and did some of the real basics of geometry and trigonometry to our fifth grade, you know, mathematics class. And it was the weirdest experience for me because everybody else was complaining about it. But I felt like what he was teaching, I somehow already knew it. and it was intuitive for me. It was easy, and so that was kind of nice. And then when I actually got to taking geometry and trig, that started in ninth grade. Again, it was so easy, and I didn't think about this in college. But boy, when I started building, I realized that understanding form, understanding physical relationships and forms of things, to me, it's a natural thing. I see it, I feel it, where it just doesn't come to other people so easily.
You know, it's going to make my next question moot, what you just said, and probably not very, I don't know what the word I'm looking for. It's like it's not even going to make any sense. I was going to ask you about your ability to take your innovations, which, you know, I mean, I was a Merlin dealer way back in the day, and the frames were magnificent. I mean, I understand form and function sort of intuitively, too, and I did bicycle fitting. Well, I still do. But I'm wondering, because people say, well, can you teach that? I don't know. Could you pass those ideas down to somebody else? I've never felt like I could do it unless somebody just sort of got it watching.
Yeah, it's not, you're asking a good question. I don't think the answer is terribly difficult. It's just, I think it might be kind of disappointing, because if someone doesn't have, at least to some degree, that natural ability to see the way some people see, it would just be very difficult. Now, a lot of people have tried to quantify it by writing programs or developing systems. One of the early ones, you know, the bike fitting system.
Yeah, the guy up Holland, was that his name? Bill Holland or something like that? The guy up in Vermont or Maine?
Well, actually, I'm thinking of Bill Farrell.
Oh, Farrell. You're right. Bill Farrell.
The VidKit thing. And there's been lots of stuff since then. Bill Boston had a really interesting one, which he developed and really well thought out, but he was never able to kind of successfully market it. And there's, you know, all the laser systems and all that kind of stuff. There's a number of problems with any of these systems, either they need somebody with an eye to make them work, or they make too many assumptions, or they don't look at all the things that need to be looked at. It seems like it should be simple, but it never is.
No, it isn't.
And one of the reasons I kind of figured out early, because, and it's one of the reasons I got into this, I couldn't figure out why my body didn't fit on a bike the way it was supposed to. You know, I'm not quite 5'7", and I'm a little short-legged and long torso, but when you make the measurements, it's not that weird. I mean, I'm somewhat gorilla-ish, but not especially. And so I shouldn't have a problem fitting on a stock bike, you know, with a somewhat longer stem, let's say. But there is no way. I ride, you know, with traditional measurements, a 54 by 58 and a half with a 13 stem.
Holy crap.
And it just doesn't make sense when you take my measurements. And way, way back when I was first starting to ride, I just couldn't figure out, and other bike people couldn't figure it out. And that's one of the things that got me so interested in this, in trying to figure out, okay, what's wrong with me, and how can that, you know, assuming I can figure out an answer, how can that help me in helping other people? And that's kind of how I kind of got started in trying to figure out a way to make it really work. Not just what I call linear fittings. Linear fittings, to my mind, are when you take static body measurements, you know, arm length, inseam, you know, sitting or kneeling inseam, standing inseam, all that stuff. Those are the linear measurements. And that would be fine if bodies didn't move and bend. And as it turned out, the problem with me had kind of two components. One was pelvic structure, and the other was an SI joint, which is somewhat unusual. And the combination of the two made for a much longer reach than my linear measurements would indicate. So that's why I don't do linear fittings, because I know from personal experience that they only work when you're lucky.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tom Kellogg, the iconic Tom Kellogg, by the way. And we want this conversation because I'll have to track him down after this year to do this again. So we're doing it now. He is retiring, and wow, I don't even know what to say about that. We're just going to skip over that for now. So I want to, and what you're saying about fitting is so the way I think about it, because just, I have a lot of, and you do too, probably, clients now who've had knee replacements or hip replacements or shoulder surgery. And suddenly, whatever you think is going to happen, when you put them up there and you start looking at them, you're going, wait, that's not what's happening. So I totally get that. I want to talk a little bit about, since obviously answering my question is, it's the only way you're going to pass this down is for somebody to intuitively watch you do it and be able to somehow replicate the thinking that you have, which of course is you fall into somebody who does that or doesn't, and that's really hard to find, right?
Well, it's that, but it's also an awful lot of, time. I mean, I've been at it for over 42 years now, but the number of people I've looked at, not just during fittings, but when I ride with people, over the years I've ridden with a lot of really the best riders in the world. I'm fortunate to live in an area that gets a lot of good riders. We're 3 miles from the Teton Velodrome, so I know and have ridden with world champions and Olympic champions and all that stuff. And so when I first started back in 76, I started building for members of the national team. And although they didn't know anything about designing bikes, they knew what worked and didn't work in something I made for them. So really early on, I had a lot of help, again, not from fitting experts, but from people who knew what they needed and kind of could help me really by criticizing what I was doing. They could say, well, look, this aspect of this bike isn't working well. What do we do? That kind of thing. I also had a lot of help early on, especially from other builders. My master when I was an apprentice was a guy in South Jersey, Bill Boston. And although he and I might have seen fitting differently, his incredible skills in actual fabrication, in building, right from the get-go, really made me kind of get what now is the easy part of putting them together. And then Jim Redke, who I worked with for years, his vision of form and beauty in frame building really influenced me a great deal. We don't do just what either of them did, but the influence of those old masters over us back in the day was just absolutely critical to what we do now.
Well, I was going to ask you something about how and what you do to determine sort of the artistic and function marrying of tubes and lugs and design, and then how that translates into ride quality. I mean, that's a big question, I know. You only work in metal. You don't work in carbon, except for forks. I know that you were instrumental in getting carbon forks on bikes, but what kinds of things do you need to do to make them look as beautiful as they do and still function the way they do and then translate into ride quality? I know that's hard, but you'll figure it out.
Sure. Okay. All right. Steel frames to me, even though my main ride is a titanium, steel frames to me have always been the most attractive when you look at tiny details or when you stand back and look at the whole thing. I think when it comes to standing back and looking at a frame or a bike, the reason I like the look of steel is because it's skinnier than anything else. It's skinnier because it, A, can be, B, essentially has to be. Steel as a material is inherently stiffer than titanium and aluminum. So to make a titanium or aluminum frame as stiff as steel, you have to make it either fatter, larger diameter tubes, or thicker wall tubes, which kind of makes them heavier, and so you make them fatter instead. And I do like the slimmer look of steel tube frames. And when you look at details, again, steel I find more attractive because in our case, we make our own logs, so we can make the logs look any way we want. And we have logs. Not all frames do, but we still use logs, partly because of the way they look, and we've been doing this since a time when everybody used logs. But also, we can make a frame last longer by using logs. Most people with steel now weld. It's a lot faster. Once you get used to it, it's easier. It also saves, an ounce and a half on a frame. But the frames don't last as long. There's a lot more stress built into the tubes, both during the construction process and during actual riding. It welds are harder on the tubes. And we've always had lifetime warranties on the frames, so logs make a lot more sense to us. And again, they're more attractive. Does that kind of...
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense to me. Yes, I like lugged frames. I like steel frames, and mostly for the reasons you're saying. I also think that there's a certain ride quality that sort of feeling you get from the road on a steel frame that is either gone on some of the carbon frames. It takes it away. I know people say, oh, but they're so smooth. But feeling the road, it's like, I think it's an important thing.
Sure. And this brings up a good point. Steel and titanium both allow you to feel the very fine texture of the road so that when you're cornering especially when you're cornering, you can tell what the contact patches between your tire and the road are actually doing. With composites, you can't tell what it's doing. And it's interesting why that is. With composites dampen fine vibrations beautifully. And that's why you can't feel the texture of the road. When you ride a carbon frame, for most of them, anyway, in a new development with a beautifully newly repaved surface, it almost feels as though the tires are a half a millimeter off of the pavement. I mean, it's really lovely. It's cloud-like. But that's as far as it goes. When you have the same bike on rougher roads, cold patch and expansion joints and, whatever, over time, over a few hours, what happens is you really start to get beat up. And that lovely ride that you thought you had really makes it hard, especially on your shoulders and upper arms. Now, with titanium and steel, you feel everything, but it just doesn't go through you like composites and aluminum do. You know, when I go over railroad tracks with my friends and everybody's getting off their saddle and using their legs as shock absorbers, I just don't bother.
Right. Just pedal through.
And you've probably experienced that. And the reason is the titanium and steel flex a tiny little bit very easily. And then they just stop. Where composites, again, dampen vibration, but anything bigger than that, and it goes right through.
So can you hang with me while we take a quick break?
Surely can.
Okay, hang on. We're talking with Tom Kellogg. He's in PA. He is one of the most iconic frame builders. If you have a Merlin or a Spectrum, or you can look down on your chainstay and see where he signed it. I love those signatures. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Okay, we're back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Tom Kellogg, and we're going to pick up our conversation. We were just talking about ride quality, but I want to switch up something a little bit and ask you about sort of the future, not just for you, but for this artisan bicycle business. The article in Bicycling alluded to the fact that artisan builders such as you and Jeff, and let's say people like Bill Boston, who I don't think is building anymore, are actually becoming difficult to find. And yet we have a lot of young builders. We have NABs. Why do you think people aren't masters like you are? And I know about masters because a lot of masters studied in Europe or, like you, studied under previous masters. Is that the reason we're not seeing so many people sort of aspiring to that today?
No, I don't think so. And working under a master can make the learning curve steeper. But not necessarily. Bill was, for me, and still is, a brilliant guy. But I had trouble learning from him just because I was terrified. Really, the guy was so smart, but I would just lock up when I was working with him. And it's just as well that he fired me. And I remember speaking with Richard Sachs. He mastered at Whitcomb in the UK way back. And they had him and Peter Weigel just doing grunt work and learning nothing for a long time. And essentially they gave up and came back to the U.S. and started Whitcomb USA. Anyway, I think what's going on now is a bit different. When I started in the mid-70s, if you had the enough kind of gumption and enough luck, which I did, you know, moving to an area where I had a lot of good riders willing to ride my bikes, you could do it. You weren't going to get rich, but you could probably pay the bills long enough to get a clientele, to get the word out and actually get enough orders to make a business of it. I don't think that's the case anymore. If you start now the way I did, it's just not going to work unless you've got all kinds of money that you can live on, you know, in it, you know, separately from building frames. I'm sorry, you can't do it. There's not enough demand for a small custom frame builder. And if that's okay for you, if you're okay building 15, 18 frames a year, God love you, great. But to make a business of it, you need to be probably at least 50 plus a year. And getting there from a starting point is just vastly more difficult. And the main reason is that your competition, you know, the shop, the bike shop bikes, the ones that somebody can walk out with an hour later, are so good compared to where they were in the mid-70s to the mid-80s. My competition in bike shops when I started just couldn't approach me. But now, man, there's a lot of great bikes out there.
Absolutely. I get exactly what you're saying. Exactly. Because if we sold a Merlin in the day, the next competitive bike in the store didn't even come close. And even though it was a quote-unquote high-end bike, it's not going to be a $6,000 bike that you can walk into any bike shop today and see a Trek hanging there that has a $6,000 price tag on it. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I just know that that's the way it is.
Yeah. Now, I will say that the service that someone like we or, let's say, Seven or Firefly or Waterford perform for a certain portion of the population is absolutely invaluable. Because again, someone like me, I can't fit on a stock frame. I don't care what adjustments you make. It's not going to work. Okay? So there is still a need for custom builders. And companies like Firefly or whatever, you know, I hope we'll continue to keep building because there are those of us who need them.
Right, right. I mean, I know there's every once in a while I'll get into one of these spats with people about nobody needs a custom frame. And I'm like, you haven't dealt with the 6'7" Violist or the 4'10" or even the guy, as I said, who had a hip replacement or a knee replacement then. If you want to ride the way you ride or the way my husband rides or the way all of his friends ride, you need a bike that fits you. And so you can ride it for 8 hours a day or whatever it is you want to do. So that takes me to the next question, which is a long view of our bike industry. And I know that you aren't actually what we would consider quote unquote part of the bike industry today because it looks so different from it was in the 70s and 80s. But what do you think about the way bicycling as a sport is going? Not just competition, but just, you know, to get people on bikes. Fewer people seem to be riding.
Yeah. Recently, I've become more and more concerned with what appears to many people, valid or not, an antipathy to cyclists by automobile drivers. And I talk to a lot of people who are effectively not really riding on the road anymore. They are searching out dirt roads and towpaths and that kind of stuff. They still love to ride, but they just feel so unsafe on the roads. Now, is that purely from volume? Is it some kind of a unexplained anger or something towards cyclists? I don't know. Personally, I do ride a lot on the road. I have not felt it. I mean, for many years, we get the classic red pickup truck being a jerk. No offense to people with red pickup trucks.
I got it.
But it seems that a good portion of them are red pickup trucks. And you get that kind of vibe where they're really unnecessarily close or cut in too soon or worse. But I am not seeing that as happening, at least around here, more often. But I am hearing more often from people I know that they're just getting off the roads.
I think it's an urban situation where you have so many more cars on the road. And instead of narrowing roads and slowing traffic down, they're widening roads and speeding it up. And people just seem to be so rude today. There's no civility. So it's a big problem in a lot of places. It does seem to exist. Certainly, I know a lot of people who have been hurt, who have been hit. Sometimes you wonder, did they take a chance or not? But you may never know that. But I think it's different from the way we used to ride. I do believe it's different.
Yeah, I agree. And we're talking kind of about where the industry and stuff is going. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, you might think that I would be wishing for the good old days, but I really don't. I'm not. I think that for someone kind of getting into cycling, let's say they're in their second or third year, so they're on their second bike now, and they just got their first, you know, real bike or first good bike because they're really getting into it. Their options now are just wonderful, where years ago, their options were much more limited. There's so much good stuff out there now. And honestly, man, for $500, you can get a hell of a bike, you know? Now, okay, it's not, I wouldn't be seen on one, but you couldn't do that before. I can tell the difference between a $500 and a $1,500 bike, but it's amazing what you can get now for, you know, not much money.
Yeah, you're right. The quality of the equipment, the shifting, the wheels, you're right. You know, it's, you know, you look at a bike that would have been comparable 30 years ago, and it really was a Huffy. That's what we were looking at, you know, with bad wheels and everything else. Interesting.
And when you think about it, that $500 bike today, okay, is vastly superior, purely from a functional standpoint, than the best bikes 35 years ago. It's lighter, it shifts better, it brakes better. So there's that.
Now we just have to get parents to let their kids ride their bikes.
No kidding.
Isn't that an interesting phenomenon? The parents are either terrified of their kids or terrified of everything else. I'm not sure what it is.
Yep.
So I want to know what's next for you. You're going to take this last order July 31st, build whatever frames are in the queue, and then what? What's Tom Kellogg going to do in his next part of his life?
Well, as you alluded to, I'm 66. My wife retired, well, a couple of years ago. She's been working, you know, a shift a month just kind of to keep her foot in the door. But that's pretty much over in the next month. We want to spend more time together, you know, the adage, more time with my family. And that's absolutely true. I do have 3 daughters and 3 grandchildren. So that, of course, is part of it. This last year, I have ridden less than I have in, I don't even know how long. You know, my typical year has been 6,000 to 8,000 miles. Last year, I just hit 3. So that's part of it. And I do want to pick up a little kind of volunteering stuff. I've always served on, you know, church committees and whatnot. But recently, a couple of people have asked me to serve on boards, one at a private school and some others. And so I really want to look at that. I want to be careful not to overload myself, but I think I can kind of help in community type things like that.
You know, there is an adage, the more you do, the more you do. And it's true. You know, I was allegedly retired in 2012. I'm busier now than I've ever been and happier now than I've ever been. Do you guys ride a tandem?
We do not. We make them, of course. No, Jude and I ride together, but we ride our singles.
Okay. How cool. All right. So I have three questions I always ask my guests. What's your favorite food, Tom?
Oh, come on. Any kind of ice cream with peanut butter in it. It's got to have peanut butter in it.
Okay. Okay. Peanut butter ice cream. Very good. So Reese's Pieces peanut butter ice cream would be a real winner for you, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. What kind of music do you guys listen to it if you have music in the shop?
Well, Jeff and I actually have a very different case. Jeff, for the most part, is classic, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah.
And I listen to what today is kind of called Americana, which is American roots through kind of modern day bluegrass type stuff.
Hmm.
If that.
Yeah, no, I got it. That's interesting. That's interesting. It's the stuff that I'm hearing a lot on the college stations here.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah. And so, do you have any pets?
Not currently. We are definitely dog people. And we've had wonderful dogs over the years. But losing the last one to old age was so hard that we just haven't been able to bring ourselves to get another dog. It was just brutal.
Yeah, that's the worst. The last thing I want to ask you is if you have any advice for a young frame builder who wants to become the next Tom Kellogg.
Okay. In one sense, I'm trying to be cute here, but not really. Don't expect to make a living for at a minimum 5 years. It's going to cost you a lot of money to get through that first 5 years.
That's great advice. You know, so basically what you're saying is don't give up your day job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tom, this has just been wonderful as usual. I don't know if you ever get up to French Fender Days with Peter Weigel.
I have not.
Well, maybe you should come this year in October, since you won't be, like, taking new orders, and maybe, you know.
We're going to be trying to build.
Well, that's true. It's only a couple days. It's not that far. It's in Vermont. And this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you taking time. I wish you so much luck in your quote-unquote retirement. We'll see how much time you take off.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, right. Well, thank you for talking with me.
Diane, thanks for calling.
All right.
This has been just lovely.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of my conversation with Tom Kellogg, and my thanks to Matt Stoller for joining me on the show this week. Please remember that each episode of the show can be found with show notes, links, and photos at OutspokenCyclist.com, and you can subscribe to the podcast on most podcast apps. And if you find one that doesn't list our podcast, just let me know. I'll fix it. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well. And remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.